Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. How are you? Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. I hope you're doing well today. I certainly am. It's been an incredibly fun week. I got to run a three-hour workshop leading people to production with Azure Spring Cloud with my friends from Microsoft. This is not a repeat, by the way, of the talk that I gave last week with my buddy Julien Dubois over at Microsoft. That was a different Azure Spring Cloud event. This was a three-hour expanded workshop, you know, interactive. People got to ask questions. We got to put the system through its paces. It was a lot of fun. I also got to record an interview, a discussion. We reviewed the news for the Message au Caractère Informatique podcast in French. And that was fun. I haven't done French in a minute. That was cool. And what else? Spent time learning how to use TV Paint Professional. I've never done that before. And TV Paint Professional is a really, really, really nice environment in which to animate like cartoons, that kind of thing. And animation is hard. Who knew? I mean, I suppose I did, but I didn't know it was that hard. Whoa, my goodness, there are some skills to be learned. But it's exciting, really invigorating what's possible. I also recorded a few new episodes of this podcast, which I, of course, can't wait to get into your track list, your podcast downloads. And, of course, I spent a lot of time this week working with the various co-presenters and people on the forthcoming Spring One tour coming in May. I think it's like May 12th or 11th, something like that. It's free. Don't forget to register. It's going to be all about Spring, all about Kubernetes. It's going to be amazing. And of course, I got to have this week's episode, which we're gonna hear in just a minute. Here, I got this. This episode was with the one, the only, the amazing, the inimitable Russ Miles, who of course is a legend in the Spring and Java ecosystem. If you've been to any Spring event, you've probably seen him speak at some of them over the years. He's a reliable, a wonderful speaker. He started a whole organization around chaos engineering a few years ago, and I just love all the stuff he's done there. He's got a company now called Reliably, which talks all about how to build more reliable systems and services. And you know, I just loved talking to him. I couldn't believe we were able to have a conversation that was on you know, it was recorded, because normally he and I used to bump into each other at different corners of the planet, and you know, to be able to talk to him and share him with you all is just such a unique privilege for me, and I was just so glad he was able to do it. He's also a COVID survivor, which he talks about ever so briefly in the beginning of the episode, and I was just, that was really interesting to me, the anguish, the peril he was put into. You know, I'm so glad. I'm even more glad than usual to have had the opportunity to talk to him. What a gem of a human being. And of course, he's more than competent in all the ways that matter as concerns a guest on the show. He's a legend in the ecosystem. He's an expert in microservices and Spring and a bazillion other things. He's been a longtime member of the Spring ecosystem, a hilarious speaker with oodles of insight to offer. And so, yeah, I was just really excited to have him. I hope you enjoy the episode. I hope you're having a great day, a great weekend.
Russ Miles, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, good evening.
Still, it's morning for me, it's morning for you, it's just not, you know.
It's all relative. You define your own mornings. Ever since I had COVID, we've realized we've redefined time. There's before today.
Yeah.
And there's tomorrow, and then there's just what's happening right now. Every time I refer to an event in the past, because of the way 2020 was, I don't use dates, I don't use weeks. It's very hard. It's just before today that it happened. And that's the way it is now. It's all very, very relative since lockdowns, I think.
Isn't that the truth? You know, I was my partner, she went back to her job, right? She took last year off because she couldn't risk my health I have really, really, really bad respiratory distress, asthma, and things like that. So she wasn't willing to take the risk by, because she interacted with other people, whereas I could do everything virtually, right?
Yeah, of course.
So she said, we don't need them, you know, we don't need this enough to take the risk. So
yep.
She gave, like so many others, she gave up a very big thing.
Mm.
The overall health of
her. Yeah, it's huge to make that step.
Huge, like crazy, right? And so she's recently been able to go back, you know, and see her friends and coworkers and all that. And, you know, it's been a long year. It's been a year. And she has a boss who is, her name is Bernie, like Bernadette, you know, just the most amazing human being, you know, just an like, you know, the kind of person I want to be when I grow up, just a successful, but also very kind, very brilliant, you know, does charity with convicts and children and, you know, just every little, there's no corner of her being that is not like inspiring, you know? So I was just, even I'm happy to have seen this person again, you know, because I just,
yeah.
She's definitely a step up for me, you know, in terms of like the moral character and all that stuff. I would love to be that kind of an awesome person when I grow up. And so my partner, she's been going back to work, and I went to go pick up my partner Tammy today at work. And there was Bernie, right? And she was, I don't know, she was outside or something like that. And so I was like, oh, you know, I hadn't talked to her in more than a year, right? And it's just really great to talk to this amazing human being. And I just felt so grateful that we had both survived. She's a survivor of cancer, you know? So this last year was particularly scary for her, right? As it was for
me. Absolutely.
And so on the one hand, it felt like an eternity since we'd seen each other. It's just an absolute eternity. On the other hand, I distinctly remember seeing her in the beginning of last year. And since all of last year was just kind of a blur of being stuck inside the confines of our home, you know, my kid, you know, we did San Francisco public schools are all shut down as well. So there's none of that. There's no markers for time besides the weather. But in California, we just have, in San Francisco, it's just, you wear a hoodie all year. It's the same weather, you know? It felt simultaneous, like it had been, you know, like we've all grayed and
evolved. It's quite profound, the difference. I went out so the pubs are now open in England, which is a big deal for the English, right? Pubs being open is important.
Yeah.
People mock us, and I mock us as well, to be honest, because, you know, we're not opening up, you know, there's a whole raft of things we don't open.
Right.
But we'll open pubs early. We'll do that one because the Brits need it. But the pubs were open, and I went out and I just sat down with my, I've got a little dog. Sat down with my puppy Sophie, and I just found myself almost welling up, just looking around at people. There are other people here, and because I went and I had COVID in January, and because it still is with me a little, it was this profound moment of not even connection, but there are humans out there, and I'm still here, and that feels so good. I feel very, very blessed and lucky, truly lucky to still be here, because it is. When you get COVID, it's like playing roulette. No one knows which way the table's going to turn, and it's a profound moment to sit out there. This was only last Friday in this. I was going to say in the sun. It wasn't the sun. It was in the freezing cold.
Yeah,
in the sun. but it was a moment to just sit there and go, I missed this. And I used to think I was the stereotypical developer. Would quite happily not be around people at all. When people see me on stage, they don't realize that I can be an incredibly introverted person.
Yeah.
And even I am now going, okay, that whole loner thing that I thought I had, I don't have it anywhere near what I thought I did.
Right.
You know, in reality, I need this contact. I need these people. So it's great. I mean, actually, my social skills have gone through the roof. I can chat away to a stranger easily now.
Oh, yeah.
Around my harbor here where I live. I just stop people. They chat. They look at the dogs. You know, we chat away. It's really good. But I never used to be able to do that. I used to be that one with the headphones on, with my head down, just trying to get to the end of the walk and then get back. Now I want to talk to everybody. And it's, yeah, I think we're all coming out of it a bit different.
Everybody, yeah, and you don't, I was never the kind of guy that would go to a park and sit there and ignore the park, but I would sometimes let myself say, okay, I'll have to wait because I've got this deadline or that or whatever. And it's just so easy to let life pass you by. And obviously you're one of the few people that I would bump into all around the planet, right? You and I have been, you know, it used to be that I could count on seeing you, not just in your native UK, but all around, everywhere. I mean, I've seen you in several different continents, dozens of countries, you know, over the last decade. I can only, you know, I know it was hard for me. I can only imagine it was hard for you as well to have your whole world go from that to wondering if you can get your next breath, you know? That's a nightmare.
It was. When in the midst of COVID, when you are at home, I'm a single person, so I'm living at home on my own. I've got the dog for company. She's brilliant, I'll be honest. I bought a French bulldog, not because they're trendy, but because they are lazy. And she is beautifully lazy. She will happily do nothing for hours on end. And that's perfect as far as she's concerned. I have to convince this dog to go for walks. She doesn't want to go out. And she went outside once and it was raining and it was like, no, none of that. Thank you. No way. I was like, you live in England. You've got to get used to this. but she's, so she was great during that period, but your whole world that, like you say, I love that thinking of it collapses down to just that moment where, okay, am I still breathing? Yeah. I've got my oxygen monitor. I'm very lucky to live in a country with, you know, we criticize our governments because that's what we do. We're all good at it. But you kind of, in those moments, you tend to sit back and realize how very fortunate you are to at least have the system around you that you do have. And I had neighbors around here. I live on a square here. So I have a very pretentious square. They call it the piazza. It's a square, right? In the UK, we would never call these things piazzas 20 years ago in England, but we've got this piazza square. But they're all the lovely neighbors here. As soon as they realized what had happened, and it becomes quite obvious because they don't see you out at all. You know, you just don't leave the house. And I had all these texts coming in going, look, if you need food, I'll get you food. If you need this, I'll get you that. And it was, again, that was another welling up moment, realizing that are these people there for you? Even though they hardly know me, I moved here in the middle of last year. So it was in the middle of all everything going on. I moved here. They haven't really known me at all. But there's lots of people reaching out. It, like I think any illness, and my experience of COVID was not that it was a serious illness in the sense of a cancer or the sense of or something else, but it was Russian roulette on a daily basis.
You just didn't know which way it's going to go. It's terrifying. You just don't know
where it's going to go, and you count your lucky stars every minute. But what it does, it's almost like an enforced meditation because you have to live moment to moment. The present is really what you are intimately aware of what you have.
Yeah.
And it keeps you very focused on the now. And you come out of it different. I mean, I came out of it with this realization that of what really matters, what I enjoy doing, what's important. And you adjust. You do adjust if you can. I'm happy to be here, my friend. So it's a long-winded way of saying it.
I'm happy to have you here, my friend. So what... you didn't quit your job as a technologist / interesting Renaissance nerd. So what do you love, my friend?
I love a very unloved subject. I think it's getting more love now, which is really nice to see. I think Google's done an amazing job of getting the world around to SRE. So it's helping me out.
Yeah.
But a long time now, to anybody that saw me on stage, they probably think I was in love with chaos. And I was never in love with chaos. I just thought chaos was the natural condition of an awful lot of systems,
right?
Including life. Right. And having that awareness meant that I was very attracted to chaos engineering, and I still am. I still love what we can do with it. But as people have realized when I talk on stage, I used to say to people, look, there's a reason we're doing this. It's not because we want to hurt systems. It's not because we want to inject faults. That's not what we're here to do. And I used to love other people in the area talking about these things and going, you know, there's a few key character traits to a chaos engineer. One of them should be empathy, strong empathy, because you're not there to hurt things.
Right.
You're there to try and, you know, if you've got a sadistic bent, then this is probably not the right thing for you to be doing. Because you can be very sadistic as a chaos engineer, but that's not supposed to be the point. You're supposed to be here to help make things better, learn from them. And so I was always doing it because, you know, particularly for me at the moment, reliability, and I noticed in the pandemic, the amount of reliance we have on any system, you know, even the basic systems, like me ordering my groceries.
Yeah.
If that system went down, I was super isolated all of a sudden. I was in a really difficult place. And so for the past probably 5, 6, 7 years now, I've been doing this because of reliability. I love reliability. I love what it means. And I love the way that SRE reminds us that perfect reliability doesn't exist. And it should. It's not the goal. But there is a level that can be achieved that still meets and even, you know, makes users happy at the same time. I love that phrase that I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he gave a talk in London. He's an SRE at Google. And he just turned around and he said, SRE is not about trying to meet users' expectations. It's about making them happy. Uh-huh. So SLAs are for when they're unhappy. They have a means of coming back on you. But that, at that point, you've really lost, because if the SLA has been invoked, oh my goodness, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You've done something really bad. SLOs exist because they define where the user stops being happy. And that was his perspective. I think there's lots of other things that SLOs are great for. But that was a lovely reminder to me that this is not about trying. And this was a big rallying cry for me in the whole reliability area, is this is one of the few disciplines in our world that puts front and center, is the user happy or not? You're here to concentrate on reliability because it makes the user happy. If you think reliability is about covering your own situation, that's not what we're here to do. And that's been a big factor. Sylvan and I did with the Chaos Toolkit, we did with Chaos IQ, and now we're doing reliably, is all about, can we help developers take this burden on? All right, because it's a it could be a real burden. It's a challenge. I watch a lot of developers struggle with this. Can I be an SRE? Can I do this? Can I even? And it's a hard answer, because SRE is hard,
right?
Because you have to be an expert in a broad range of things.
Can we define it for
go on, please.
What is you know, let's define a few things. What is chaos engineering? What is SRE? And then let's work from there. Just some
chaos engineering is the experimental introduction of turbulent conditions to a system to see how it responds, to gather evidence of how it responds. And when I say a system, it's the socio-technical system. It's including the people, the practices, the processes, the game that surrounds, and it's best done with production eventually. I have this, most of the people I've worked with gradually take their experiments from, I would say, less critical environments into production once they feel ready to start doing those things there. And then they increase the scale of their experiments when they get there as they get more confident. But it's about learning how the system truly responds, not just how we think. And actually, I think all these things are related to the same principle. And the principle of this is we're moving away from what I used to call hope-driven development. We make a lot of technical choices, right? So say you're going to adopt Kubernetes as an example, right? You're going to put in place Kubernetes. So you're going to get some Kubernetes expertise in the room, hopefully. There's so many bells, whistles, knobs, buttons you can press to make Kubernetes do what you need it to do. And it has those facilities for good reasons. But how do you know they're good? How do you know when you add in, and actually I had this recently, I had a great conversation. One of our big users. I said I won't list the tech stack that bought, but they've bought a great platform, a runtime platform. They've bought into a language ecosystem that is very well supported with all sorts of reliability facets, as far as I'm concerned. So that's great. So they've got circuit breakers in there. They've got all the bulkheads, et cetera, right? Brilliant. They've bought into the right what they feel is the right set of dashboards they need. They bought into the right HA setup that they need. They've done all, they're multi-cloud, they've done it all. And then I said, so what happens when something breaks? And they, and the answer is evident in their eyes. We don't know. We think, but we don't know. So chaos engineering is about that. It's okay, how do we get better at knowing what happens? We can practice it, that's another step. We can verify, so we can actually say, yeah, we can tick it off and go, absolutely, this is how it responds. Yeah. We can experiment and learn from it. But chaos engineering encompasses all of that, as far as I'm concerned, brings it all together and says, look, treat this as a scientific problem. You've built, you've constructed a complex system. Almost every production system is complex. Yeah. When you take it holistically.
Sure.
You've got this thing in place. You can't just rationalize about it. You can't just say, and that's where the hope comes in.
Yeah.
You know, you write it out on paper, you've got lots of whiteboards, you've got lots of sketches and stuff, but what really will happen? And it doesn't matter if you've done microservices, distribution, whatever. It's usually complex enough for you not to know what will happen.
You're continuously integrating entropy.
Yes, exactly you are. And it's... Actually, there's Jim, a gent I used to work with, a really super smart person. He understood it very carefully that, you know, you're fighting entropy all the time. You're fighting this. And this is another fight, another sort of tool in that fight. Chaos engineering is a big tool for that. The problem I have with chaos engineering is often how it's perceived. And I sometimes say this, the name kind of works against it. We're not engineering chaos. That's easy. You know, I used to joke, and I do mean it as a joke, very tongue-in-cheek, but say, if I want more chaos in my system, I'm going to go and get a bunch of interns, and I'm not going to give them any documentation. I'm going to see what happens next. But that's not the point. That would just be chaos, and that's already evident in the system. You already have that as a recognized condition. What you need to do is engineer yourselves out of chaos a bit.
Yeah.
Into a world you can begin to reason about and go, this is how it responded today. This is how it will tomorrow when we do it again, because these things should be practiced more frequently. We can do it again tomorrow, do it next week, do it next month, whenever.
Yeah.
But we'll, at that point, we're gathering more evidence.
Right.
And I actually said, I had this conversation recently. Someone said, yeah, when should I run my chaos experiments? I said, actually, one of the easiest indicators is when you have any turnover of staff. If people leave, wouldn't it be a good idea to learn how the system reacts now? When all of our customers started to work from home at the beginning of the pandemic, they started to say, we're not going to run the chaos experiments for a while because we're not sure how this is going to go. And I said, this is the right moment to choose the smallest experiment and try it.
Right.
You want to know how the system reacts now. Everyone's not at the dashboard. They can't go there and see the things. They're not sitting next to somebody to tap them on the shoulder anymore. How are all these systems going to come into play now? And this is where it dovetails, I think, with resilience engineering and everything that John Allspore talks about.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it moves into that. We're doing this to learn something. Chaos engineering, I see, as being like the first very valuable step into that world.
John Allspore is a renowned researcher who worked at eBay and Flickr. Was it Flickr?
Mm, yeah.
And
John Allspore worked at Etsy.
Etsy, but that was, I think it was Flickr before that. I could be wrong, but either way, he did. He's one of the original DevOps luminaries from, you know, yeah. I remember seeing his talks at O'Reilly. Microservice, the Vanguard.
It was Velocity?
Velocity. Yeah. I remember seeing his talk like 2009 or whatever. So he's another person I would love to have him on the show, you know, in the same.
Yeah.
He's just a legend. But anyway, carry on.
He is up there. I mean, as somebody that's taking the whole area of safety and resilience into our world, he's coming in at it at such a powerful level. So, yeah, he's a super, super important voice. But to go back to your definition, so chaos engineering is that, I see, it's a foundational tool. And it's a big mind switch And this is where we may disagree, so this might be fun. So I've actually gone on stage and quoted and said, look, I love Josh, but I disagree with him on this. You famously say, and actually you quote it in the book, the SRE and Java book, you say, take your kids to production. And I jokingly say, I don't hate my kids that much. I think we're saying the same thing, but yep. From very different. But you've got a positive perspective. I have an extremely negative perspective. You know, you're from the States, I'm from the UK. It's obvious. Right. You know, we have histories and these things. But the whole point is that production is a beautifully hostile environment when things are working. And I see it as chaos engineering is a great reminder to all of the optimists in the development teams that optimism is misplaced in that world. It's a world where if it's going to break, it will break there. I talk to friends of mine who work in motor racing in Formula One, and they still do their production shakedowns. You never know how the car is going to perform until it's on the track, and it's the worst possible moment for it to fail.
Right.
That's what production's like. It's the worst possible moment for you to learn, but it's also the place where you're most likely to learn the most important lessons.
Yeah.
And chaos engineering, I think, just embraces that the lessons are there to be learned and our optimism is misplaced. And it's a natural optimism, by the way. I think I should point this out. I think the best developers in the world are slightly optimistic. We have to be.
Sure. Yeah.
We're in incredibly complex systems, which we're held enormously accountable for. We've got to be optimistic.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. But at the same time, it's a reminder that optimism is misplaced, but you can do something about it.
Yeah.
So what was the next concept we want to dig into? So it's chaos engineering there as a foundational.
Yeah, and then what is an SRE? How would you distinguish?
What is an SRE? So with SRE, I really subscribe to the view that, I'm just checking my book list here. John Schneider, the author of SRE, Java and Microservices, which you know very well since you wrote the preface to the introduction for. I love the idea that he presents in that of being SRE is kind of, it's a recognition that you can apply developer type thinking to the problem of reliability. You can treat this as an engineering problem.
Right.
And there are two cultural facets. There's the place where SRE was captured and you could argue invented, certainly given its label, which is obviously Google. And they have a means of using it. They have a cultural basis for how they use it. Netflix, on the other hand, is a subtly different approach to SRE. And that's incorporating their cultural elements. And we've seen this a couple of times. When chaos engineering was being characterized and invented, it was done as part of a centralized group in Netflix. They at one point, I think they were even called the chaos engineering group. It's the same with SRE. It was kind of characterized in Google as a centralized group of people. First of all, these companies are big enough to support them. Right. they can actually have centralized, dedicated groups to do this. But when you see these good practices, these engineering practices move into the wild a bit more, to move into more context, more cultures, they tend to take on different forms. And that's not wrong, right? That's not bad. It's just different. And we're seeing that at the moment is that SRE, if you take it as an engineering approach to reliability, is being adopted gradually by lots of organizations who, yes, they may need SREs,
yep.
Or they may not. They may just need developers being better enabled to take this responsibility on.
Right.
And that you know, you can see there, that's kind of where my new adventure comes in, to be honest, right? That's where I'm going, the phrase that I used to use is that when we set the bar for developers to do their job, we used to say developers, come to work, write code, go home. Now, for good reasons, we say come to work and it's on you.
Yeah.
It's all on your shoulders now. You write it, you run it, DevOps, it's all on you. And that's a huge step up. Very important, but a big step up. And there's a lot of people I know in develop, you know, sort of been developers that have been very fearful of that step. And then someone like I come along, right? Someone like me comes along and says, what you're going to do is you're going to need to do more work. So now you're going to need to write the code, make sure it's good, write chaos experiments, see how things break, try and do it safely. And then John Allspore comes along and says, you're going to need to think about all of this resiliency stuff too.
Right.
And then there's the security stuff as well, because you want to do DevSecOps. So it's, that's on your shoulders. I think we can say right now that the cognitive load on a developer is huge to do their job in a modern, what I would call a modern way.
But have you thought about
talking needs to help?
Absolutely. And I think that's just it, is we are, we have started to treat every other discipline more like software. And as a result, we have the ability to test and to codify and to repeat and to automate so much more beyond just the code that I write that somebody else would then historically have deployed. And then somebody else would have managed and administered and scaled that, whatever. Now it's sort of, well, of course we can do all that. It's just a text file away, certainly, but with that must come corresponding abstractions that allow us to scale out not just what we're doing in terms of the pragmatic reach of our code, but what we can understand and manage and think about and rationalize and abstract away in our mind. You know, like we need to build higher abstractions to match the more speed, you know, speedy, more streamlined processes.
Yeah. Yeah. The limiting fact, as a limiting factor always is, and whenever I hear the phrase "it's a people problem," I go, "Yeah, it's a brain problem." Usually, it's the brain, how brains don't really communicate to each other very well.
Right.
So yeah, we have this situation, almost a perfect storm at the moment, of people being asked to consider reliability, developers being asked to consider reliability. It's not something we're familiar with worrying about.
Right.
We usually develop with a high degree of either naivety or optimism, because we believe things work. And I count myself firmly as bracket. Chaos engineering taught me a lesson, is that everything I knew was wrong. Yeah, and everything was breaking all the time. And I was like,
everything we do is wrong, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really helpful. Well, so where we're coming with the stuff I work on at the moment is we're trying to help the developer.
Yeah.
We are trying to give the developer a set of tools that help them not just do SRE. So this is an interesting thing. I think SRE is great because it's treated reliability as an engineering problem, something we can think of like software. That's great. But all of that thinking involved in it at the moment is manifested in this person we call an SRE. And they are few and far between. And really great SREs, they're gold dust. I love these people. I will never be these people because they are that smart. They've done 10 years longer, not as an SRE, but cutting their teeth on operational challenges whilst also still having a developer sensitivity. So it's amazing what those people who can do the job can do. You know, it amazes me continually.
Oh,
the world doesn't have them.
Yeah.
The problem is the world isn't populated by these people, which is a real shame. So what we need to do is, as the need to engineer reliability becomes more mainstream, more I think democratized is one way of looking at it, but bringing it into the teams, helping the teams do this, which is the cultural difference between one of the cultural differences between how Netflix do it and how Google do it. Netflix, it's like enable the team to do this. Right. Google, we have a centralized group that can do this with you.
Right.
It's a slightly different model. At least it used to be. I think it might be changed. That's great. It means it's going into the teams now, which means you're back to that problem of the teams sitting there going, I've now got to engineer reliability too. I already had enough to do. Thanks.
Right.
So yeah, this is where we're at the moment, is that we love reliably my current company. We love SRE. It's a perfect movement. It's a perfect discipline to remind the world to take these things seriously. The problem is we believe that developers can do this, but they're going to need enormous help to do it well and to save their brains from everything that needs to go with it. So, yeah, we're we build this little tool. It's free. It's some a good portion of it's open source. And it helps people try to do, it does two things at the moment. It does preemptive, looks at your code bases and tries to tell you if you're doing anything recognizably that could do with being improved from a reliability perspective. So it, little things, it might notice a circuit breaker and it'll go, look, have you ever thought about testing that circuit breaker? What does it actually do?
Yeah.
Because one problem, yeah, this is from our hard learned lessons in the past. I used to go and see systems 5 years ago that have got the full of circuit breakers. And no one's ever asked what happens when they start to break in fun and interesting ways. And so that's one of the things we try and suggest. The other thing that, I mean, we look for obvious things in Kubernetes manifests or Terraform right. manifests. So, you know, you're doing things here. This would be more reliable if you did X. The key thing we're doing, and it relates back to defining SRE, for me, there is one artifact in SRE that matters the most, and that's the SLO.
Okay.
You need to have an, if you don't, actually, I heard a Google rep say this once, if you don't have SLOs, you don't have SRE. You need to call it something else. And I think that's probably fairly true because it's the key communication medium. It's the artifact where you can say, this was what we were aiming for. This is what, yeah, this is our decision point. This is this is our identifiable signal to say that we have a moment that we need to do something about reliability or not. And I think without that steering vehicle, that steering device, you really are left with hope again. You're left back out in the wilderness. And so SLOs are massive, and we have that now in Reliably. You could, but we do it differently. Actually, it's interesting because you can do SLOs. I love, you know, in Honeycomb you can do SLOs, Datadog you can do SLOs. All these fabulous toolkits for doing observability and helping you look after runtime systems and debugging them. It's all in there. It's great. The problem I have is that it's all in these things. It's not in the developer's, you know, fingertips.
Right.
And what we've done, it's small. It sounds like a small thing, but I think it's an important thing. We think it's an important thing. We've said that actually this is, you know, the SLO is a piece of code.
Yeah.
And we have a phrase internally, we call it reliability as code. Can we make these artifacts of importance code? And by making them code, we put them in places where developers are.
Yeah.
They're in code bases. So now they're, I mean, at the moment it's YAML, you know, forgive me, it's YAML. I'd love it to be some other things, but YAML seems to be winning. So it's in YAML, it's in the code bases, which means it's subjected to all the opportunities your code has. It can be reviewed, it can be approved, it can be part of your, yeah, it can be configured. Even better, it can actually be configured because that's actually important to an SLO. Right. You can have an SLO without SLIs. Now, for those that maybe don't know what an SLI is, that's an indicator. The job of a service level indicator is to provide kind of good and bad events. So this is good, this is bad. I've seen this, this was good, this was bad. Because then that gets rolled up into the objective and you can go, okay, am I meeting my objective according to all the events my indicators have seen?
Yeah.
All right. I've seen this now a few times. There is a good reason to have an SLO without SLIs. Even if you can't detect these things yet, you can say this was the objective and we know we don't have indicators yet,
right.
But we need them. It's okay to discuss the objective before you know how you're going to meet it or, in fact, how you're going to measure it.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing.
So what
we do at the moment, we've seen this with a few of our users, is that they're using tools like Datadog and Honeycomb and others that can give them, even give them almost the SLO in its entirety, which is fine. But we then bring that into the world of the developer as a code artifact as well. And so they can see it, they can code it. And what we're trying to do then is begin to centralize the understanding of the SLOs. So this is a different thing, right? SLOs don't live, they're not islands. And a lot of tooling right now treats them as islands. Once you've got your SLO, you're good. But SLOs, particularly in a broken down system of different services that depend on each other,
interact.
They don't live in isolation.
Right.
And nothing that I'm aware of right now is really helping you, helping a developer, but also helping the whole company understand the relationships between SLOs. You can do that if you can dig the SLOs out of these places, these silos, I guess, where they already are, bring them into your code as a as an artifact,
right?
And then bring them all together in a picture that says, I can now see how my world is looking from an SLO perspective. I was talking to a great friend of mine, Anavan, who's heading up SRE at Disney Streaming, so Disney Plus. And you want to hear some stories about handling incredible production moments. Things like, you know, WandaVision episode six, I think six, seven was just a moment for them because everyone was getting on board with the story and their uptick was huge. I think they've grown in 1 year. If I misquote this, please let me, you know, people will let me know. In 1 year, they've grown as much as Netflix did in 4 or 5. And so it's been an insane journey. They now claim to be one of the, if not the biggest, consumer of Amazon AWS resources. Which is amazing considering they were zero 2 years ago. Pretty much. So when I talked to him about it, one of the things he was very validating on is that SLOs are the key concept. They enable that conversation. It's something a developer can grok. It's something a developer can learn from and use. It's something upper management can grok. And so it enables a conversation around reliability that never used to happen. I'm always listening for those things. When someone says this enables a communication, this enables a conversation, that's where I get excited, because reliability is the poor cousin. Security gets a lot of attention because it gets a lot of press. Reliability gets, less. I mean, not none, but it gets less.
Unless it goes wrong. And in case it gets all of it.
Yeah, it's nice that this is – so SLOs for me are so powerful that they become the conversation enabler. But also, obviously, they have a technical manifestation that's helpful too, that the daily developer can sit there like myself and go, I know how things are going at the moment. Yeah. No, so, yeah, long-winded way of saying this, so that's what I'm excited about at the moment.
where do people learn more about this?
So the best place to go there's a whole pantheon of books on SRE, which I would recommend all of them. But I also realize humans don't have as much time as I do to read books. I would really love people to look at the SRE with Java microservices book, even if you're not a Java person. Please go. I mean, I'm not, you know, I should point out here, you know, you haven't told me to say that. No one has spoken to me about it. But I honestly, it's a great distillation of the kind of technical challenges. If you're coming at this as technical, I'd go there and have a read.
John Schneider, he created a, he was on the podcast. He's one of our
Podcasts.
And he was the co-founder of, among many other things, Micrometer, right?
Yes.
With the instrumentation library for Symmetrics Facade that you're using in Spring Boot 2.0 and later. So, you know, awesome book. I love the book. I was very impressed, like you. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. What I loved about it is I'd read all the other SRE books, love those too. But the problem with those books, if I'm being honest, pushing people at those, is you aren't Google,
right?
And in fact, you know, I used to say to people, you aren't Netflix, you aren't these things. These are grossly simplifying phrases. What I'm saying is your context is always going to be slightly different. Sure. So, and because SRE and SLOs in particular are cultural elements, they're things that help you have different conversations, your context really does matter. So right. You can read those books and it's a good idea to, but they are, you know, you do have to go at them with an awareness that you're hearing one company's story, which is okay, but you need to, you mustn't cargo cult. Is it please don't cargo cult, because it's going to really that could hurt SRE if people start doing that. It's the same thing with, you know, everything else in our area. If people just do it naively, then it tends to hurt everybody and the thing itself.
Simon Wardley did a great bit about strategy and all that. And he talks about how, you know, so often we do one thing in response to some other company having done that. And so the classic example is Uber for X, where X is paying you. And he says, that's not how the real world works, basically. You don't see military leaders charging up a hill just because somebody else charged up a hill. That makes no sense. You have to have context. You know, it's all about situational awareness.
I love Simon's work. That's actually, I mean, I recommend that to anybody anyway. I mean, everything he's done is open and available. Wardley mapping, you just Google that, you'll find it all. It's so helpful. And yeah, his concentration on the landscape and the environment when making strategic or even any decision is super helpful. It's been really good, really good for me as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so where else to go to get more information on this? I'm always going to say reliably.com. Go there and have our blogs, our resources. We're writing new things every week.
R-E-L-I-A-B-L-Y?
Yes. Okay. Literally the word reliably.
Okay.
.com. That's where we are rapidly sharing this vision that I've talked about today with people and giving them the tools to do it. So hopefully that's a useful place for people to get stuck in. A lot of it, Reliably is just a command line interface. It's a CLI. So if anyone wants to, it's open source. If anyone wants to dive into that, that's all over on GitHub. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is just reach out to me. I'm happy to talk to anybody about this because I learn too. Back to that point we made earlier, but you know, Simon talked about context is king. Context matters. Environment matters. I love to talk to people about this.
Where do they find you on the internet, my friend?
You can ping me on Twitter, just at Russ Miles, okay. Or you can pop me an email, russ@reliably.com.
All right. Do you have a last word before we wrap up, my friend?
Yeah. I guess the last word would be that I think it's a really exciting time to get into reliability. In the past, I would have said, wow, reliability, that's got to be boring, right? You know, that's going to be the thing I don't want to do. I think right now, reliability is having a renaissance. It's extremely good skills to have to get hired for good amounts of money, et cetera, right? So it's a good career move for people. And I think, you know, forgetting even, you know, my company, reliability is starting to get the same attention as security. And that's really, really good for the world. The last thing I want to leave people with is I have a small group of people that I regularly jump on a call with. We're going to start doing it once a month, once every 2 months. The reason it's that infrequent is because of the group of people that we gather.
Right.
So they tend to be people that are the responsible and accountable individual on something big. So for example, it's, you know, Olga is a good friend of mine, Olga Hall at Amazon Prime. She's a part of the group. Anna Van from Disney Streaming. If anyone out there's interested in, and it's a two-way street, you have to come to those sessions and share.
Yeah.
But you also are going to hear some of the truths of what's going on, what people are actually trying to do when reliability is a massive challenge. Even if you're not a big company, it can still be a critical challenge.
Yeah.
And so we are having those conversations there. And it's great. I mean, I can say right now, when Amazon Prime say they've got a scaling issue, you listen.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a great little group. It's a very small group right now. We've got a few more people that are keen to join us. I'm going to keep it kind of small. But if anyone wants to try and be in that room, to see what people discuss about when they're trying to do reliability in some of the most hostile production environments,
right.
Then yeah, just get in contact with me again. Email or Twitter is good.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to have talked to you again, my friend. I hope we meet again sooner rather than later in person, you know, on the other side of this nightmarish moment. Yeah. I've missed you, man. I really have. You know, I can't wait to code with you, right? Obviously, we've just been talking about big stuff in this, but
yeah.
Been involved in the Spring ecosystem for longer than I have. You know, we can write code together again. I miss that. I just miss hanging out and
talking. I couldn't echo that more. Echo it more, my friend. I hope to see everybody soon. There's a whole world of people that I've hardly been in contact with during this period, and it's lovely to chat to you. It's going to be so lovely to get back in the same rooms.
Sooner or later, my friend. All right. Good morning to you.
Good evening to you.
A Bootiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.